Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and journalist, and we're welcoming her back, Amy Fusselman. And we're talking about her new book, Idiophone, an essay. Amy, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
You too, Mark. Thank you so much.
You wrote me an email sort of asking me if I'd be interested in this book. And the way you phrased it, I forget what you said. I had to say yes. It just was incredibly intriguing. Now, the last time we talked was about Savage Park, which was a really interesting book and a decent piece of sort of journalistic reporting. But more than that, too, more than that. And then I was unprepared for Idiophone. And the first thing occurred to me is she taking ayahuasca on the Amazon River and hallucinating and then writing everything downstream of consciousness? This is really different, isn't it? Or do you write like this all the time? This is the first time I've seen it.
No, I mean, this is definitely a departure. And it has, you know, I mean, I think you put your finger on it, and then it has it has kind of a psychedelic element. It's not, I mean, I'm sober. It's not a drug induced, but it definitely was, it was a trip, like personally, artistically, it was absolutely a trip. And I'm grateful that I followed those impulses rather than shut them down.
And it would be so easy to shut it down too. You know, I could, especially having written, you know, you wrote sort of straight on stuff before, but there has to have been something that precipitated this. What was it?
Well, I'll be honest. It was, I was writing, I was just sort of noodling around, and I started writing this poem that I felt had this traction. It really was this sort of rhythmic thing. I feel like it began kind of musically, finding this sort of form of this kind of staccato, sentence by sentence form. And I felt like it was sort of a door I went through. It was a little Alice in Wonderland-y, and just of where this would take me. And
The first thing I thought of when I started to read it and right up until the end is that this is a performance work.
I would love, I mean, that would be dreamy, but it's not. I think you're right in the sense that it's a text that is, you know, it's not 10 ways to, you know, train your dog. I mean, it's a performance in the sense of the words are performing, and they're not working as, you know, explainers or information, you know, bombs. Like they often, I mean, and that's, you know, they're useful that way. But in this piece, they're not doing that so much.
Well, and it's interesting for me because I read a lot. I'm reading 2 to 3 books a week, and most of it's nonfiction. And I do cover poetry, too. For this, it seemed so personal. And that's why I also thought it was a performance piece, because I got a deep sense of who you were from Idiophone, not so much from your other work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was – maybe it was a pivot as well, in the sense that – I mean, I loved Savage Park, and I tried to do justice to this thing that moved me, that was the impetus for the book, which was this playground and how I felt about it. But ultimately, you know, I'm not the kind of writer, I think, who's interested in presenting arguments about anything, really. I'm more interested in art making. And nice. I think to myself that if Savage Park was a book like about play, then Idiophone is the book really where I kind of gave myself permission to play.
Nice. Would you call it a poem?
Well, I did, yeah. I mean, I was thinking that it was, but it's not, you know, there's some rules of poetry that it doesn't really live up to.
There are actually rules of poetry?
Well, not really, but I think maybe from a marketing standpoint.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
It's very prose, you know, it's just very prosaic, and I'm happy with it. I think essay is interestingly a form that is very elastic in 2018, and I'm happy to have the, you know, Idiophone's flag planted in that territory.
Well, I just, for the benefit of the audience, I just want to tell you that this is, I think it's a unique thing that you did. It's not an essay. It's not a poem. It's sort of a conglomeration at times, one and the other. And it's really something to read. Like, you can't sort of stop. You have to sort of follow the thing all the way through to the end. You don't sort of put a bookmark in it. I just found like I had to read the whole thing.
Oh, that makes me happy. Yeah, I did. I find the like movement, you know, pieces of writing that have that kind of movement to be my favorite. So I'm happy that you experienced it that way.
Now let's talk about some of the things that this idiophone is about. First of all, let's talk about idiophones. What are they?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're a type of musical instrument, and the idiophone of the title is the slit gong in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it's a piece of art that I've returned to at the Met. It's a musical instrument that is it's very striking. It's in the middle of this gallery in the Met with a lot of space around it, and it's majestic and exquisite. And it's you strike it. It has a long slit down the center, and it's carved from the trunk of a single breadfruit tree. It's from the island of Vanuatu in the South Pacific. And this instrument is used both for communication and for celebratory and ritual reasons on Vanuatu. But it made a connection in my mind with this other tree, which is this tree in the Nutcracker, which is also a piece of art. And a tree that the symbols of these trees, in a way, they were almost like antenna. They were kind of the source of around which, like, the radio waves of my language, I think, were sort of circling.
It's interesting because there's a lot of different things that come in and out of idiophone, and one of them is the situation for women writers. Mm-hmm. Is they're sort of in the background. And then when you talked about that slit gong, I started thinking of that as a female symbol. And then
Very much so.
That it was like emitting, it was giving out messages as a woman writer would.
Yes.
And so there's that.
Yeah.
And then throughout the entire book is an entire history of the Nutcracker, which is mind-blowing. When I try to describe this book to people, I honestly leave them with their mouth agape. Like, and I feel like, well, here, you should give me a bunch of the copies and I'll just distribute them. Like, just read it.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, that's actually helpful because I haven't found my own, like, elevator pitch about it either.
This is not easy to pitch. It's literally, you have to read it.
Yeah, I did find the Street Guarding the Nutcracker. I mean, I felt like this sort of thing, my interest in the Nutcracker had been building, and it was, I do see the Nutcracker every year with my kids, and it is my favorite holiday ritual, and partly because I'm a lover of dance and of live performance, but the Nutcracker narratively is insane. Like, I would just go every year and have my jaw on the floor. Like, I just, it's so odd, you know, because you hear, like, I mean, it's so difficult to get a piece of experimental fiction published, and yet the entire United States has rallied around this absolutely batshit crazy story, you know? I just was always like, this is whack. And then when I found Jennifer Fisher's, like, beautiful book about the history of it and Tchaikovsky's experience sort of writing literally from, like, a post-it, you know? Like, he was just writing these exquisite emotional phrases of music off zero direction, almost zero. And I felt so much, I just felt so connected in that moment with the problem, like the artistic problem of just like getting shit made off nothing, you know? I'm glad you're laughing. That's good.
Well, it's because having read it, you know, that's the way you sound in this book. This book, it's like, people, I mean, except more so. And the great thing is, you know, of course I know Nutcracker. I don't go every year. And maybe I will now. But there's so many things I learned about it that just sort of jumped out of me. Like, nibbles of fat play a role in the plot.
In the original, not in the Lincoln Center production.
What does that mean? Like, what are nibbles of fat?
Just little bits of fat. Yeah, in the original story. I mean, it's the backstory of the Nutcracker isn't. I mean, the ballet itself is insane, but the backstory is insane, and it just when you read. I mean, Fisher's book does a beautiful, excellent scholarly job of just sort of tracing how this piece was shaped and formed for audiences. And then what's even more wonderful, I feel, is the way in which everyone wants to claim the Nutcracker. You know, there's so many it's like you cannot find an iteration of the Nutcracker that hasn't been made. And how also, I mean, amazing is that? Like, why is it that we rally around and want this crazy story for ourselves? There's an element of the matriarch in the Nutcracker, I feel, you know, that we use it for our own ends in this way that's really kind of amazing as an art piece.
Now, that's one thing that's throughout this book. And there are a lot of other themes that come and go. One of them is your alcoholic days in your youth.
Yeah. I mean, I felt that was, I opened the story with sort of this image of exhaustion and fighting, which the Nutcracker for me, like the battle of the Nutcracker is sort of basically narratively the piece is over like in the first, 45 minutes, and then it's just dancing candy. And then, so I understand, like, battling, you know, and who doesn't? I mean, it's 2018, like, we're all battling. And so this idea, really, of battling and passing out, and, I mean, I'm sober, as I said, but there was a time when I wasn't, and that is another fight, you know, it's like...
There's also battling with your mother. As a matter of fact, a quote from the book, sometimes a battle can be eating lunch with your mother. And I really identified with that. I know what you mean by that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, families are tricky. I have one of my own now, but it's like, I wanted to explore those sort of the underbellies, the little things on the floor. I sort of wanted to look at the stuff that I felt was sort of getting brushed in the corners of some of these stories.
Nibbles of fat brushed in the corner.
Nibbles of fat. Yeah. Crap on the floor. What's going on down there? Yeah.
I know. There are times you sort of became like a racer head. It was like there were things underneath. Yeah. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and journalist Amy Fusselman, and we're talking about her new book, which is an experience to read, Idiophone, an Essay. Now, okay, there's that. And then there's certain things that I just love that you stuck in. Pancakes.
Yeah.
With syrup. Wow.
Yeah. Well, I had another reader tell me that pancakes sort of take the they become sort of like the doors to another world. Like if there is a, you know, they're kind of a in another writer's hands, they might have been like the tab of LSD, but they are kind of, you know, the balm of pancakes, the sucker of pancakes, you know, the kindness, the benevolence of pancakes.
They were the warm bed. There was warm beds that go everywhere in this story, too.
Yes.
And they were another warm bed that you could just – and I've had those pancakes where you're just so tired and they put the warm syrup on it and you just want to lie in that pancake.
Totally. I want to do that right now. Yes, exactly.
Can I get you to read the pancake section?
Yes. I mean, that's kind of the pinnacle of my pancake love came in this. It's like kind of near the end. It's maybe where, you know, George Lucas would have put like the big battle scene. But then I just have this kind of pancake rhyme. And I really like it. So here it is. Now it is time to have pancakes. We had them already, yes, but now we are having them again. We were just thinking about pancakes, and now we can have them again. We can have pancakes a million times every day of our entire lives, like red-hot pokers applied to the spine. We can have pancakes with syrup on them. Let us take the carafe of maple syrup. Let us hold it aloft. And now I'm going to pour syrup on my pancakes, and then I'm going to pour it on my kids. And then I'm going to pour it on the slit gong and all the other artwork in the Met. I'm going to pour syrup on my family, on my husband and three children, on our apartment and our building, on Lincoln Center and Radio City. I'm going to pour lovely maple syrup, which is a syrup that comes from trees, which is a sap that flows from a tree, and in which you can lick right off a tree. You can do this by kneeling beside it, as if you are about to make love to it. You can lick syrup from its hole, and this is something you should do right now. In the meantime, I'll pour syrup on quilts, and I'll pour syrup on boilermakers, and I'll pour syrup on ballerinas, and I'll pour syrup on mice and roaches. I'll pour syrup on computer keyboards, on the Talking Heads and Tchaikovsky, on Beckett and T.S. Eliot, and on the status of women in publishing. I'll pour maple syrup on it all, warm syrup from my glass carafe. I will pour and pour maple syrup, and then I will eat everything. Yes, then I will eat every last thing maple syrup was ever poured on.
That needs to be recorded by some alt band. I'm not kidding you. That really, I need to play that on my rock show. I absolutely.
Oh, awesome.
It's like that. Now, all sorts of weird things happen to the narrative. Like, it becomes like the Nutcracker in that there are mice and bunnies, like, running around. Like, you write, the white baby bunnies make the best medics.
And yeah.
And so all of a sudden, the your narrative of your life becomes like the Nutcracker in this.
Yes, the animals and the cars and yes.
There's a drunken cockroach in this. There's a drunken
cockroach. Yes, woohoo! Yeah, right. Yeah, I think of it actually as kind of a Richard Scarry-esque movement in the sense of, I don't know if you've read those kids' books, but it's just, I love him so much because it's just endless. He is like a great physical comedian, like, visually, and just endless car accidents. It's just endless car accidents. And that's kind of what I wanted happening here in this piece.
Now, there's other things about your mother, which were just, and that seemed like it was a complicated relationship. Is it? Obviously. I don't think anybody has an adult person does not have everybody has to have a complicated relationship with their mother.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's like, I didn't want to, you know, this isn't the kind of book where it was like, here's my relationship with my mother and I'm going to tell you about it.
No,
it was just enough to say, you know, this exists. And also, I'm a mother, you know, so there's a scene with my 13-year-old where that I wanted to put in there that's like, he's kind of looking at me like, you know, what are you doing? You know, and I feel like I wanted that depiction of maybe, you know, I feel like families are often like kind of two speeds, you know, they're either idyllic or it's just like a total, you know, nightmare. And I hope a little more for all the bizarreness of this book. I hope that those emotional moments are a little more of in a gray area.
They really are. They really are. You also have some interesting give and take with a choreographer, dancer, and director, Annie B. Parsons.
Yeah, she is a phenomenal choreographer and dancer who's done a lot of wonderful work and lives here in New York. And recently is she actually choreographed the dancing that's in David Byrne's new opera or Broadway show. I'm not sure which, but I've seen her work and I know her personally. And I interviewed her about dance.
And that was really interesting what she had to say.
Yeah, I mean, her view of dance as a space in between, you know, as something that's a source of distrust because it doesn't communicate in the way that it's like certainly that language does. Her point is that, you know, the word is the primary source. I had asked her why so much theater, neglects dance, doesn't include dance.
It's, right.
Whether it's musical or, you know, or it's people talking, you know, or crying or whatever. And I thought she just so beautifully stated how dance, which is a province of a territory of women, you know, a territory of harlots, was something that had long been distrusted, and that she viewed herself as a sort of steward of the the form. You know, it was, I mean, to have those words in this piece is like humbling for me. I'm so grateful for her just to and happy to give them, I hope, a wider readership, because I think she's, what she says about dance is so amazing.
I found it really fascinating. Now, before we're going to run out of time, I want to give you a chance. I had picked the pancake section because it at where it came just so totally surprised me, and I was sort of tickled by it. But I want you to read a section that you pick and that you want to read.
Sure. I'm reading in this little passage about the Nutcracker ballet being similar to a game that I played in kindergarten called Telephone. The Nutcracker is a game of telephone. We used to play telephone in kindergarten. You sit in a circle, and one kid whispers a long sentence to the kid next to them, and then that kid whispers it to the kid next to them, and on around the circle. And then you compare the sentence from the first kid to the sentence from the last kid, and it is funny to hear the differences. The sentence has always changed from what it was in the beginning, and the way it has changed is something to marvel at. It's a game about a sentence in which a sentence transforms. It's a game about a sentence in which a sentence is free to change. It's a game about a sentence in which the words have no single author. It's the very first sentence and the very last sentence that you compare side by side. It would be interesting to see every single one of the sentences written down and laid out in a long line. You could see the little changes in each one. You could trace the steps from beginning to end. It would be like watching a dance piece in which the words were the dancers. Telephone is not a game about a single person having an important idea. Telephone is a game about the movement of ideas and the movement of language across and through people. Telephone isn't about one all-important writer flapping their handmaiden hands alone in a room. Telephone requires a bunch of people sitting in a circle. It requires people talking to each other and listening to each other and making mistakes and examining them. It requires a slender opening like the one in a 14-foot-high slit gong. It requires the absence of a single territorial author mind. It invites the ancestors to come and talk. It invites them for a witnessing. The telephone game is a witnessing. The telephone game is a monumental tree in the middle of a party. The telephone game sees everything. The telephone game has a twinkly star like a lampshade on its head, and it knows, and it doesn't care. It just shines.
That's an amazing piece. And,
Thank you.
When you write about, you know, obviously as a child I played telephone, and that you write, everybody just looks at the first and the last sentences. But if we all looked all the in-between sentences, when you wrote about that, I realized that took the whole metaphor to a whole different level. Mm-hmm. That was fascinating. And it was a beautiful section of this, which is an amazing accomplishment. I have so many questions to ask you about this. Did your mother really have a sculpture called Construction?
Yes. My mother.
So that exists?
Yes, it exists. Yeah, she has it.
Okay, we're going to leave it for readers to find out what that is, because that has a sort of a bit role. David Byrne in The Talking Heads has a bit role in this, too. You lived across the street from David Byrne.
Yeah.
You get to watch his ankles or something like that.
Yeah. He was a floor down, and I would see him sometimes. He's no longer in our fabulous neighborhood, but it was fun when he was here. I like the way the Talking Heads and Tchaikovsky also, like, those three words sort of were so similar. So I like the word slippage was able to happen in this piece.
How did E.T.A. Hoffman end up?
He had a a really horrific sounding death where he slowly lost, you know, his faculties from like his feet up and became, you know, numb and was not able to move his extremities. And he was a very driven person, though,
right.
from all accounts. And he kept dictating. He dictated work to his secretary basically until the moment he died. Or that poor man, yeah.
I know. Now, once you create a piece like Idiophone, is it going to be tough to go back to the writing that you did before?
Well, I don't think there's any going back. Yeah, there's only going forward. Yeah, we'll see.
I mean, was there a sense of catharsis when it was all over?
Well, I feel very grateful that this piece is seeing the light of day, frankly, because it was, you know, it was hard. I mean, it wasn't easy to find a publisher for it. And
I can imagine. Was there a lot of awful rejection notices?
Yeah, there was just a lot of I just was alone with it for a long time with a lot of incomprehension, and I get it, you know, and I was trying to sort of reconcile myself with that, and I'm just very grateful to be able to share it. I really am. I hope people find something joyful in it, because it was definitely a joyful project.
Oh, it is. I think it absolutely is. And it's just fascinating to read. It's like a different experience. And that's what really tickles me about it. I mean, it was not like anything I've read before. And in that sense, I just found it enjoyable from beginning to end. It was a really cool experience. I don't know how you're going to top it, but that's your problem, not mine.
Exactly. That's a nice problem to have.
It is a good problem to have. And whatever you come up with, come back, because we'll cover it. Because I got to see that. I got to read that.
Thank you.
My guest tonight is writer-journalist Amy Fusselman, and we're talking about her new book. It's one of the great reading experiences I've had so far this year. Idiophone, an essay. Amy, it's a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.